I had not enough anorexia that I would have been put like into like a hospital, but I stopped. I would basically hide the muffin and flush it down the toilet, and then when I got to school, I would give my lunch to my friend. So that way I was only eating dinner, and then it was only I could get away with only eating like a salad if it was like a tennis night, because I was able to say, oh, somebody brought some food, I'll just like eat a light salad when I get home because I'm kind of full and tired. So I did that, and she had no idea. She was pleased I was losing weight. It wasn't until I collapsed on the tennis court that my coach, he knew my family dynamic, and he knew enough to not go to my parents. He knew that would probably not help me at all. So he said, listen, as long as you're willing to keep talking to me and help me figure this out with you, he said, it won't go further than us. And so he helped me get back onto a better mindset shift.
Welcome back to the Weighing In with Patrick podcast. The next installment of our little project is featuring the voice of Amy, who's been in our little group since, I believe she said, 2022. And she has really been inspiration to a lot of the folks that go to our Saturday meeting. And this first part, we had to kind of cut it up into three parts, but part one is Amy's origin story. All superheroes have an origin story. And she talks about her career, her family, both her family of origin and the family that she is currently leading with her husband. And she talks about her upbringing and some of the challenges that she faced early on. And again, very serious stuff, you know, and I don't want anybody to think that, you know, this is somehow an exercise in voyeurism. You know, when we are talking to folks that have had very challenging life experiences, and it's all for the purpose, you know, remember, everybody shares what they want to share and what they feel has value. And I'm one of those individuals that thinks that virtually everything somebody shares has extreme value to somebody out there. And I hope that you listen intently to what Amy's story has been. And I will shut this microphone down and present to you part one of three with our friend Amy.
Boys and girls, your attention, please. Presenting a new exciting radio program featuring the thrilling adventures of an amazing and incredible personality.
Welcome back to the only podcast dedicated to a local community of Weight Watchers devotees. And now here's the podcast Sherpa himself, Mr. Fantastic Patrick Hull.
Welcome back to the Weighing In with Patrick podcast. This is, I believe, our 10th episode. Double digits. We did it. We are going to be graced with one of our tribe mates who has been coming to WW, the in-person meeting on Saturdays, practically as long as I can recall. And we have watched this individual grow and shrink at the same time. And it has really been wonderful and inspirational to witness. I'm sure I'm not the only one that thinks that. I would like to welcome Miss Amy B to our podcast. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
I'm very, very thrilled that you had decided to participate. And I'm curious, what might be some reasons that you had for agreeing to do this?
Kind of simple. It was just, why not? I think I'm, even though I'm quite chatty, I typically hold back a lot and was kind of nervous. Do I want to participate? I'm not sure. And then I just decided, why not? Let's just do it.
What would make you nervous about sharing your story?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I think there's, in some regards, I feel like there's a lot I've gone through. And then other times, I'm just not sure if, is there an interest in what I've gone through and kind of what's made me me? But that's why we're here.
I'm going to assume that you've listened to some other episodes.
I have, yes.
Is there any episode that stands out in your mind? And you can say no. Is there any episode that stands out in your mind? It's like, wow, that was a really helpful.
Not in particular, but I would just say in general, it's nice to hear other people's stories in the short time that we have together with everyone on Saturday mornings. You know, you don't get to really dive deep into what makes those people who they are. So mm-hmm. I think right. That's what's really great about this opportunity.
Is there anything about what you've heard so far from the folks that have been in the hot seat, as it were? Anything that you're surprised at, like, wow, that seems to be a common thread in people's experience?
Well, I mean, I do think, and we hear about it as well on Saturdays, that there's so much commonality amongst us, even though we all may have come from, you know, different journeys to get to where we are today. To some extent, the struggles that we're facing today, the challenges, the triumphs, the successes, whatnot, I would say just have so many common threads amongst them. And I think that's what makes us become friends and colleagues from when you first enter the room and you're kind of strangers with everyone.
Yeah. Funny how that works. Are you comfortable sharing what you do for work?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I work for a global software company, and it's the main headquarters is based in Germany, and I am the service offering manager globally for one of the lines of business, so HR software. So I help create services, help understand the strategy of the line of business and the company, understanding kind of global HR challenges to figure out what the gaps are and how we can help promote and sell what our service can deliver to our customers around the globe.
Wow. What of your personal or professional strengths plays well with your job?
Well, I very much like to engage with people. Although I'll call myself an introvert extrovert, I do really like to engage with people. And so I love working with people all over the globe. So I'm fortunate to be able to work remotely, but I do work with people in all different time zones. And I think it's really great to understand the background and experiences that people bring. I also really love to uplift people that may not have the chance otherwise to be uplifted. So I really like to give opportunities whenever we're creating new services and I'm the leader or manager of the creation process. I really like to try to seek out some individuals that I feel this is a growth experience for them, or they just haven't been given this opportunity to kind of shine. And so Like, I've got a couple people right now in mind with that. And it's just great. They're exceptional at what they're doing. And I've made sure their manager and their manager's manager, I've emailed them to share and appreciate their effort. Mm. So
how did you find your way into that occupation?
Yeah, I always call the jobs I've had as stepping stones in life. So I went to college initially for marine science, changed to religious studies, and wanted to be a professor of religious studies and focus on gender dynamics within religion. So that was kind of my focus when I graduated. But a lot happened in the world after I graduated. 9/11 happened to happen right after that. And I was on an internship that summer. And so for those that are younger, you're going to laugh at this, but I opened up the newspaper and just literally started looking for jobs. Was like, I just need a job that can pay. I will take anything at this point. So I got into the home building industry and was an assistant to somebody that was helping with some of the marketing things with a home builder. And I decided I wanted to do more than that. I felt my degree and everything, I just could offer more to the company. So I started learning some of the architectural design principles. And then I started going, even though I graduated college, I went to college again. And I took, building codes, whatever the current building codes were that year. And I took residential plumbing, residential electrical, and hurricane design and construction. So I was taking classes so that I could do more with architectural design. Ended up moving into that part of the company. And I did light architectural updates because I was not an architect. I did light architectural changes to house plans. And I also cleaned up all of the house plans that we needed for marketing brochures and whatnot.
Can you tell me what is a light architectural?
I could do anything that really needed an engineering background, but if we needed to, they wanted to change where the electrical outlets were, add electrical outlets, but I couldn't do anything that structurally required a change. So moving a window, roof designs, exterior walls, I couldn't do any of those changes because those really required somebody that understood the engineering impact to the changes.
Do you own a tool belt?
No, actually, I do not.
Could you change out, when I heard you say the courses that you've taken, like, does that mean that you could, if you needed to, you could change out the faucet in your kitchen?
Not anymore. A lot of time has passed. But I think if I watched videos, I could probably be handy.
Some of that might come back.
But yeah, it was more if I look at if somebody's, buying a house or building a house and they're presented with, well, here's all the information, the ratings of the insulation and all that. I would be able to look at that and be like, sure, if I like that rating, that's enough for it. I still have some knowledge in that space. So yeah, I went there, went to a custom home builder when the housing bubble was starting to burst in Florida. Then the housing bubble really burst. So I went and decided I want to work for a larger company. So I went and got a job in HR, human resources, for Home Shopping Network. And thought, okay, I'll just kind of work my way up. And while I was there, they wanted to purchase some software and implement it. And I saw that as, that sounds, like I could secure my job a little bit more if I was involved in that project. So I did that and really enjoyed it. And then the company that owned HSN, I think they had a divestiture. So HSN got to basically rebuild their own software. And so I said, well, this is great because I had literally printed out the manuals and had read like cover to cover everything administratively. So I said, great, we can rebuild it. And I think we can save a lot of money because I remember everything we did the first time around. That took notice on the software company because they were wondering why they weren't getting billed for so much work, but yet the project wasn't on hold. Like the project was going much faster than they expected. Mm-hmm. And yet their consultants weren't really working on it much at all. And so, but they can't poach from customers. So I ended up by just kind of inquiring myself to see, oh, you know, it'd be kind of fun to just do this all the time. So I ended up by applying and took the leap into that company's software. Did that for like six and a half years. And was a consultant. So I helped implement recruiting software for customers. And then that company got bought up by a much larger software company. And the buyout was a little challenging, I will say. And so I went on LinkedIn and I had gotten inquiries from a competitor. Mm-hmm. And I went to the competitor. So I work now for one of the largest, I'd say we're probably in the top three largest software companies in the world.
So your current career, where on the globe, what's the farthest it has taken you?
So I've been fortunate, I guess, because I like to travel, but I don't love to travel for work at least. So I have not had to travel too far. I've gone to the Galway, Ireland office. Mm-hmm. So I was able to go and train a group there. Loved that whole area and that office. That was amazing. I've had customers all over the United States, and I've had customers, Calgary was probably the furthest away, that I had. Yeah. For work outside of, you know, it wasn't customer facing, but when I did the Galway training. I haven't been able to go to Germany yet. I keep hoping one of these days I'll get to go to the Waldorf office, and I haven't been able to go yet.
Do you speak any German?
I do not, no. Thankfully, our company's language is English, mm-hmm. unless everybody that's in a room speaks collectively a different language, in which case that could be spoken. Otherwise, whether I work probably a third of the time with people in APAC, probably largely in some of our Bangalore offices or Singapore. And so everybody I interact with, which is what amazes me, they all speak English so well. And yet most of us in the United States might have a little bit. I speak a little French, but not probably enough.
Most of us in the United States don't speak English very well.
Yeah, that would be true. Yeah, absolutely. But it's impressive. Most of the people I work with speak at least two languages.
Yeah. Wow. It sounds like you've never met a challenge you didn't accept.
That would be true. I do like to challenge myself, whether it's, you know, personally or professionally. I like to really prove something, not just to myself, but usually to the people around me. I mean, that's literally how I got into the service offering manager job that I'm in, the role that I'm in now. I went from being a consultant to realizing I didn't really want to be a project manager, wanted to not be in a silo of a region, and really wanted to be global facing. I like to work with the other lines of business that have other types of software. Mm-hmm. And so I work with them. I liaison with them. I like to learn.
In the corporate world, success is usually very well defined. Personally, however, I think everybody has a different idea of what success means. They can define what success is. So how do you define success on a personal level?
So I think that's actually a little hard for me on a personal level, because I spend so much time and attention on work and family. I don't spend as much time. That's one of the things I think I've been learning about myself in the past few years, is to spend more time on what it means to be who I am. Like, I never want to stop learning. So I definitely think learning is part of being successful. Finding joy, I'd say just learning and joy is probably success.
If I say the word failure, how do you think about failure? What is failure? What is the meaning of failure?
I'm probably over concerned and worried about failure in life, whether it's, you know, in any facet of life, I guess. So I give like 150 50% of myself to whatever I do in order to try anything to avoid having failure, even though I am well aware you learn from it. And I always tell people, don't be worried to make a mistake. Don't be worried to ask, you know, questions. Like, this is how we learn. I personally don't want to let, I don't know if it's so much failure or letting people down. I don't want to let people down that are around me.
Yeah. What state are you from?
So originally I was born and raised in Massachusetts, wearing my Boston shirt today, but born and raised in Salem in the North Shore of Massachusetts, spent most of my childhood there, spent high school years along the coast of Maine. So New Englander at heart. You can pull me out of New England, but that's going to still be in me.
Well, and so that might, I would venture to guess, being at the North Shore might explain the interest in marine science?
I would say that I was always just fascinated. I come from a line of sea captains. Salem was founded by sea captains. And so I come from a long line of that. My parents very much wanted to instill the history of both sides of my family, but it was from both sides. And so I was always fascinated with, you know, the sailing, like on the schooners, those 2 or 3 masted wooden schooners and stuff. Got to do that in the summertime. Some of the summer marine science camps I went up, sailed from mid-coast Maine all the way up to Canada on them. And yeah, just really took an interest in that. I wanted to study behavior of dolphins, sharks, or orcas. That was really...
What had your interest in those particular? Are they fish?
They're mammals.
They're mammals.
Yeah. I feel like there's a lot to learn from them. Like, people fear sharks, for instance. That was like my one niche I was really interested in. And I felt like people fear it because they don't understand them. And like, I really looked up to...
And of course, they'll eat you.
Yeah, that's true.
There's that.
But I really looked up to Jacques Cousteau. I remember reading, what was it? It was Diane Fossey's book. She had studied the gorillas in Rwanda. And so the books that I read, like for fun, I read... Diane Fossey's book, and it was like a lot of science. I looked up to some of those people and was like, wow, how great could that be to just be in the wild and your only focus and your only job is to understand what you're studying and how it could help both people and the environment because of what you're learning.
Right. Where'd you go to college?
Eckerd College in St. Petersburg, Florida.
And they had a marine biology?
It was one of the only colleges at the time in the late 90s that actually had marine biology as a major for undergrad program. Mm-hmm. They actually, University of South Florida, which was in Tampa, Eckerd College based the undergrad program off of their graduate program for marine science. So it was quite challenging. I didn't make it past my freshman year with that major before switching over to religion, but yeah.
What was it that you were like, science, I'm going to go over here towards the religion?
Yeah, it's a great question because it's such a departure there. But I think for me, I really, and I still do very much have an interest. Like, we're really hoping this summer when we go out to Washington State, we've already booked like an orca expedition because I really want to see orcas in the wild. So I still have very much a passion for it. But I think it was a combination of, I ended up again like walking pneumonia my freshman year. That made it very difficult to study my background in science. I learned that you can have a passion for something, but if maybe my background in high school wasn't as strong in the sciences, maybe it's just because of how much I put myself into it or how much the school, you know, brought to me. I don't know. That ended up by impacting. You know, it was a struggle, honestly. And so I had a great mentor in college that said, let's not worry about a career at the moment. Of all the classes that you're taking, what class is the most exciting to you? And I was taking women and religion course. Mm-hmm. And I said, man, I mean, if I could take a whole bunch more classes like this, this would be great. And they were like, well, why can't you? And I was just like, well, I think, do you just study one religion? Do you study more than one? I'm a Christian, but I'd like to learn about other religions. Is that going to be a conflict? And they just said, no, only if you make it one for yourself. And I said, okay. So that's what I did. And I ended up by learning, what's the three Western religions. I also learned Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism. And it was, I thought it was great. And then I loved understanding the gender archetypes that occurred within religion.
Mm-hmm. Was that, do you do that graduate work?
I ended up, I couldn't really afford at the time to go on to graduate school. Mm-hmm. So even though I wanted to become a professor, I was like, okay, I'm going to have to try to work. So I was doing an internship at the time through the Lutheran Church, and was helping with the farm workers in Dade City, Florida. And so I was like, okay, maybe I can do some internships and then see if I could somehow get a church to help sponsor me to continue. And so that's kind of the path I was looking at. When 9/11 happened, and I was like, I need to actually be getting more income and find a path.
Any memorable volunteer experiences?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, some of it with the farm workers, there was basically this opportunity to help teach and provide a safe space for the children when their parents were in the farms mm-hmm. and in the fields working. So I learned so much from that experience about them, about myself, about how fortunate I was in life, mm-hmm. And yet how much joy they had in life with not having a lot. Mm-hmm. A lot of the tents and the places that they lived were difficult, to know, that's where they were living. But, that's probably one of my most sort of touching experiences that I went through.
Stays with you.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. You are married?
Yes, I am.
And you are a mom?
Yes, I am.
How many children?
So I have two children. Ennis turned 25, and Katie turned 17. So,
how did you meet your partner?
Yeah, I met Jason through work. He actually was working at a marketing company, and since I was working for the home builder at the time, cleaning up some of the stuff and helping with marketing campaigns, I met him. So he, it was a small marketing company, so everyone kind of took shifts and turns, like answering the phone. So I would recognize his voice. He answered the phone quite mm-hmm. a bit, and but that was pretty much it. And then I got invited to their Christmas dinner, or big party thing. And so I, drove to their office, and they had a limo take everybody. And that's, he kind of caught my eye. And
did you know he was going to be there?
Well, I knew everyone was going to be there, but at the time he hadn't really, just hearing his voice, I knew he was like friendly, but almost everyone there was friendly. I'd worked with them for like a year or so. It was really interesting. I think we sat next to each other, but one of the things I noticed, so everybody loved to party at this company. Mm-hmm. And so but I decided, nope, I might drink some coffee, but otherwise I'm not, because I'm in my, early 20s, like out of college. I'm going to have to drive home. I have no idea what time this is even going to end. It's going to be nighttime. I'm driving home, and I just wanted to be responsible. So I kind of was like, all right, well, everyone's, having fun and partying and drinking it up, and they'd go to bars after they had dinner and all that. Like,
party after them.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I'm not a partier. So I was kind of like, okay, but it's like, you can't get out of it because you're, in their limo. So I'm like, all right. And I think that's one of the things that attracted me to him, because he was not a partier.
Yeah.
And so we were able to actually soberly talk, mm-hmm. and that kind of drew us toward each other.
Yeah. Kind of put it out there first, like, yeah, I'm interested.
I did, which surprised me. And I actually was talking to my husband the other day about this. I said, it's so funny, because I'm not usually that forward a person. Mm-hmm. And so his aunt and uncle owned the marketing company, and his uncle approached him at the bar and said, "Hey, like there's two chicks over here." And I don't know what it was about that moment, but I was like, "Oh no." Like, and so I immediately started talking more to him and kind of expressing an interest. And I didn't realize that he could have cared less about the chicks at the bar. Yeah. But that made me make a move. And I've never made a move before that time. I did. I made a move. Yeah.
You had to shut down Uncle Roy's intentions.
I was like, nope, this isn't going to happen. So, yeah, I mean, it, looking back, even we laugh over it, but it, you know, and he did say, he's like, if you hadn't, because he's a more shy person. Yeah. And so he's like, I don't know if I would have made one, but, you know, right. we could tell there was something there. But yeah, I don't know what came over me that night. It literally was not alcohol because I was not drinking right. at the bar. But yeah, I made a move.
What are some of either your strengths or limitations that are, you know, kind of, you know, hand in glove with his strengths and limitations? So he might have a strength where you have a limitation and vice versa.
Yeah. So we've also talked about this. It's interesting. So we've been married for 20 years. This year will be 21. And in the beginning, I was more reserved and more structured and reserved because that's how I had been brought up. Mm-hmm. And it kind of was just what I knew. And he was a lot more kind of laid back, like to have fun, easygoing. And so we kind of called it the yin and yang for each other because he could kind of bring me out and would be like, hey, let's be spontaneous and let's do this. And then I could help him with some of the like, hey, a little structure's not so mm-hmm. bad. So I think, you know, because he's only 6 months older than me, we both kind of just brought into this relationship those aspects. And now I would say he's almost as structured, maybe, I mean, probably not quite as structured as I am, but yeah, I never, cause I didn't instill like, hey, you have to be this way, but yeah. he on his own kind of was like, nope, I like to do things this way or this way. And have I loosened up? Yeah, I have, but not completely. Mm-hmm. I'm not quite the spontaneous. I can handle it, but I'm not quite the spontaneous person.
Sure.
That maybe I'd love to be.
You talked about growing up in Salem, North Shore.
Yeah, our family house is still there. We went a couple of years ago. Everyone got to see it. It's still on the historic walk, which is really cool. It faced the common right there, which is where like the circus would come to yeah. town and all that. And yeah, we got to walk to the library, the Salem Public Library. That's where my mother had worked there before I was born. And my grandfather, he was like the head of the public library, but then he was also a researcher. So he had traveled over to the South Pacific and done a lot of research. So, we have a lot of like family artifacts that are in the Salem Peabody Museum, and yeah. he's credited in quite a few books as a historian.
How far back how far back can you trace your family roots?
So my dad is better at tracing everything back. My family came over on the Mayflower. Okay. So
which passenger?
I don't know. So that's the problem. I know. Like, I know who I can trace it back to because my parents still have some of the portraits of the sea captains mm-hmm. that were like hand painted, and they have eyes that follow you, by the way. So mm-hmm. like if you walk in the house, you're like, ooh, yeah. it's kind of, they're spooky, but you have to be able to have a trace it back mm-hmm. in blood to be part of the Salem Marine Society. Mm-hmm. And my mother and I were some of the first females allowed into it. And that was, I think, in the early 2000s or so.
That's awesome.
Because it was all, you know, males because they were the sea captains.
Yeah.
And, but what's ironic or kind of cool for me is that I could trace it back to with both of my parents through that history. So that's really cool, you know, with all of that. So it's definitely a neat history, but like to this day, my parents get very irked if you mention like the witches or anything in Salem, because that's what people resonate Salem
sure.
with,
mm-hmm.
not like founding families that helped
yeah.
to kind of make it as it was. But it was really neat. We got to go see the House of Seven Gables, mm-hmm. and that was passed between both my dad's side and my mom's side. That house went between both of our families.
Wow.
The House of Seven Gables. So it was really neat to
You're
be able
referring
to go
to
back.
The House of Seven Gables that also shares the book title.
Yep. Hawthorne wrote about it. Yep. So it was really neat to, like, you know, my parents are, you know, of course, on the, I don't know what you call it, board, whatever, of it. And sure. so they, you know, but I didn't want it to just be when we went up there, just about family stuff,
yeah.
you know, but it was neat because I hadn't seen a lot of that stuff in ages.
You know, what's really neat about the, you know, being descended from folks on the Mayflower is the tentacles, the branches
mm-hmm.
are crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Like how many different presidents you're likely to be distant cousins with.
Yeah. So that's like, what my dad does. Yeah. I don't know how many people that he'll be like, either through marriage or birth, he'll be like, you're related to this person and
yeah.
this person and this person. And
yeah.
it's, you know, but yeah, it is crazy. I was able to through, you know, the Mormons keep such a catalog
yep.
of all the genealogy. And mm-hmm. so I was able to personally put in just a few people and all of a sudden it was like ding, 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 ding. And it went all the way back to 1400s. I can say I'm definitely very British. I don't even need to do one of those blood ancestry tests because it's on both sides.
Yeah.
It's like heavily British on both sides.
Right.
And so it was interesting to be able to trace things all the way back to like the 1400s.
Yeah.
And be
that's
like,
awesome.
Wow, that's crazy.
What can you tell us about the family you grew up in?
I was an only child and it was a structured family. I feel very fortunate for the opportunities that I had. I went to private school. I went to, you know, we tried to really learn a lot of, you know, history in the area and stuff. We didn't like fly places or whatnot, but, I also, looking back, I think there were a lot of things that were done just because of appearances. It made me and shaped me who I am. I also wanted to be as distant from that type of rearing as I could with how we've raised our family.
Mm-hmm.
Because it, you know, it kind of, there were elements that broke me and I didn't want that in our kids' lives at all.
Yeah. Many folks that I've had the opportunity to speak with, both, you know, on this podcast and just in the course of just everyday life, especially folks who've struggled with weight over their life, you know, usually it wasn't just them and their family that may have had a weight issue. Were other members of the family, did they have any weight issues?
I mean, my father has off and on. He's tried to, you know, he's always been able to, just with a structured diet, be able to lose the weight.
Mm-hmm.
So he definitely has off and on. Usually you could attribute it to how much time he put into work. And so it just, you know, between work and then the commute back home to where we are living, it just, you know, there just wasn't time. It's not
yeah.
like you could get up earlier. He was getting up at 4 something. Like
yeah.
he couldn't get up earlier.
Much, yeah.
You know, he got home and only had probably an hour or so before they went to bed. Like he, you know, and the level he had at companies, it just, he had a lot of stress.
Yeah.
So I do think for him, it was like more stress and stuff. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. She never really seemed to struggle with weight. I mean, she was never thin, but she was just kind of average weight. But I do recall multiple times as I got to like middle school and high school being told like suck in your stomach, and like, as I said, it was a lot about appearances and those things. I was like, no, whether I have a child that may be more becoming, I will never say words like that to a
mm-hmm.
child
right.
because it haunts you.
Yeah. So So it sounds like there was some messaging about weight that you received. As far as your peers growing up, did you have like a best friend, a really tight group of friends?
I've only usually had small group of friends, even now to this day. I don't have large groups of friends. It was difficult in private school. I think when I was younger, I had more friends. But all of a sudden, as you got older, meaning like late elementary school and kind of I left when I was in sixth grade, there was a lot more like comparison. So if you weren't the kid that when you went on a ski trip, you weren't going to the Alps, like we weren't even skiing at all. Like, and I mean, not that my parents weren't able to afford private school, but that wasn't enough, right? You had to do more. My mom loved to knit, so she would knit me sweaters. Well, she didn't realize that that really made a kid stand out when they're wearing a homemade sweater versus, you know, these kids going and getting expensive designer things, right? So the older you got, the more that kind of stood out. I had a couple friends there that were close, but I started to get bullied. One of the reasons that I left and went to the school that we were living in Hamilton on the North Shore, north of Salem at this point. And so I definitely made some friends there. But as soon as I made friends, like 3 years later, we moved to Maine. So it's like I had to start all over again making friends. And
how old were you in that move?
Eighth grade. Yeah. So basically I'd had like a year and a half, 2 years to have friends in like the public school area where we lived. And I thought I had some good ones. And then all of a sudden we moved.
Yeah.
So that was like, okay, we've got to. And then it was the coast of Maine, which was beautiful, but a stark difference to where suburbia that we lived in on the North Shore.
Right.
So, yeah, just never. And even as an adult, you know, and I work remotely now, so I do have friends, but like, you know, they're in different states or in different countries.
So you mentioned getting bullied. And again, you don't have to expound on that beyond anything that you're comfortable with. But was that just you're getting targeted for that type of treatment by peers that weren't necessarily in your, you know, circle, that didn't really know you, and they were just picking out, well, you're wearing this, or were they going after you for other reasons?
So they were kind of the mean girls, I guess, in school. And I learned that the mean girls in private school were quite mean. Like I you know, there's always been people vicious that are like mean girls, but the ones even in high school were nothing. I was like, oh, I can handle it. Like, you know, there's nothing like that. But no, I mean, they actually called after I left in sixth grade. They thought they had called anonymously, not realizing you could dial a number back. And my dad did. And they called and started like threatening me on the phone. And I don't even recall what exactly happened, but I know my dad went to the cops because he didn't care for it.
Wow.
So
what did you think about that response?
I mean, my dad's always been quite a protector, but I do feel like you don't want to, he's not a person you would want to mess with. Like if something doesn't sit well with him, he will make it known. He does not, you know, like if, you know, a waitress doesn't do something right or whatever, he would always be very vocal and make it known. He was never the type. I mean, now that he's gotten older, he's, you know, loosened up, but he was never the type that would just be like, oh. So it was great as a kid to know, well, at least your father has completely had your back.
Yeah. Did any of the behavior change after that occurred?
Well, I didn't see any of them because the private school wasn't in our town. I was thankfully able to, and there was no social media or anything else. So I had no idea if they just stayed that way or what, but
did you get any messaging from, peers, friends, teachers, anything like that about weight stuff?
No. And I had friends that weighed less than me. I had friends that weighed more than me. Weight really wasn't a big thing at all with my friends. I think for me, it was always a personal thing. It was either something that I felt like my mom would notice. And so I would try to, you know, because obviously I'd have to go to her if I had a get bigger pants or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I was pretty much average sized until I hit puberty. And then I gained like 20 pounds that year. And then I was, you know, it was kind of a struggle to, you know, lose some of the weight or keep it off. I definitely noticed it in, I guess the only time nobody ever brought it up, but I personally noticed it was when I played varsity tennis all 4 years. Mm-hmm. If you've seen tennis skirts, they're really short and tiny. Mm-hmm. And I was like a size 16 and everybody was like probably a size 2 to 4. So I personally noticed that. But I will say nobody ever said anything. Nobody ever was like, oh, because I was still running around doing laps with all of them. It wasn't like I couldn't keep up with any of them. Yeah. But I was definitely bigger. So I noticed that because they would all be completely comfortable wearing the little skirts. Like we used to have to wear the outfits mm-hmm. on game days.
Right.
And which nowadays you're like, look back and you're like, why? Because those were so short. My mom was like, no, you must wear biker shorts under them because she was like, you're not wearing those because those skirts did not
yeah, right.
have them at the time. And, but honestly enough, nobody said a thing. Mm. It was always me.
when do you recall that began for you? Like what's the earliest that you remember having, a thought about your weight.
I think honestly going through puberty, I remember going to the doctor's office and the doctor herself, I just remember being a little roundish and her saying, you know, you might need to lay off juice. Like I was in eighth grade, gone through puberty. My mom was in the room and my mom, as a stay-at-home mom, she liked to make everything from scratch and she would always make sure we had a cookie jar. She always made sure I had muffins in the morning. She always seemed that, you know, thought that was always very healthy and stuff. So mm-hmm. they didn't blame any cooking on anything my mom made because she said everything's from scratch. Nothing's in a box. There's no sodium problems, whatnot. It was always going to be about, oh, well, you know, she did say like, well, maybe you should restrict the sweets that she eats. And then there was also just, you know, don't drink juice mm-hmm. or soda. Like we'd only have soda on the weekend. I think like maybe once, like I'd go to my friend's house and they were always having like sugary cereals and soda. No, we would have soda only as a family. You did not drink it unless you drank it with the family on like a Saturday night. If you got pizza, like that's when you would have soda.
Yeah.
Or if we went out instead of having that and we would go out. But if we went out, it was usually to fish places and we'd get like fried seafood
because mm-hmm.
that's what you got up in Maine. Like you would get, you know, your clam strips, your,
yeah.
you know, fried baby
the
shrimp.
Really healthy stuff.
Yeah. You yeah. know, but it's just interesting because now when you look back at it, it's like, okay, so like if one of my children had, if they only were at home or school, and so they're not getting food anywhere else, mm. right? They don't have a car or anything. They don't get food anywhere else. And they had a weight issue. Wouldn't I, as a parent, be partially to blame for that maybe? Because of what's in the house? Because of what I'm making for meals? Like, I just love how that was, none of it was on my mom at all. Mm-hmm. It was all on me.
Did your mom, you kind of alluded to it, but just for clarity's sake, did your mom give you, you know, hey, you know, you got to, we got to lose weight. Mm-hmm. So that
in high school, like right. after that doctor's appointment, she was like, wow, I didn't realize what you weighed. And she's like, we're going to have to do something about this.
Hmm. What was that like for you when you heard that?
It was tough because I didn't have the best relationship with my mother. Mm-hmm. I wasn't very close to her at all. I was closer to my father. And yeah, it was a little tough to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't like, hey, you know what? We're going to get through this together. We'll figure it out. It wasn't like that, which right. is how I try to do stuff with our kids. It wasn't that at all. It was very much a like, yeah, we're going
to. Was it a like, oh, you're overweight. You need to do something about that. And then was there any intervention from mom at that point? Let's try this differently. Let's do this differently.
It was just cut out things. It was, okay, you're not going to be allowed to eat ice cream. Oh, but we still will be. Yeah, you're not going to be, I'm going to stop buying the juices for you, but I'll still buy some of this stuff that I mm-hmm. like. Right. You better make sure that you eat that muffin. Like she still had me eating her muffins and everything. Mm-hmm. Instead of being like, I'm going to cook some scrambled eggs or something. No, she still had muffins. She you know, made, even though I should have made my own lunch, she made my lunch. So I was stuck with whatever she did. And I think it drew me to, I had not enough anorexia that I would have been put like into, like a hospital, mm-hmm. but I stopped. I would basically hide the muffin and flush it down the toilet. And then when I got to school, I would give my lunch to my friend. So that way I was only eating dinner. And then it was only I could get away with only eating like a salad if it was like a tennis night. Cause mm-hmm. I was able to say, oh, somebody brought some food. I'll just like eat a light salad when I get home. Cause I'm kind of full and tired. Yeah. So I did that and she had no idea. She was pleased I was losing weight. It wasn't until I collapsed on the tennis court that my coach, he knew my family dynamic and he knew enough to not go to my parents. Mm-hmm. He knew that would probably not help me at all. So he said, listen, as long as you're willing to keep talking to me and help me figure this out with you, he said, it won't go further than us. Mm-hmm. And so he helped me get back onto a better mindset shift.
And that was part one with Amy. Some good stuff in there and some heavy stuff in there. I had to figure out a way to go into the next part, you know, part two, and where do you make a break there? I apologize if that seems overly dramatic. That's not necessarily my intent. However, Amy's story is not finished by a long shot. She just really strikes me as someone who has, you know, been through a lot, like so many people out there. And that if you just have a quick conversation with her, you would not necessarily pick up on any cues that would indicate that she has had some times in her life that, wow, a lot of pain. And like so many folks in the world, it would seem that, you know, the pain did not cause Amy to retreat from life. And much like steel, that pain strengthened her. Do we, or does she wish? I'm sure she doesn't wish that she had to go through some of those things. None of us want to have to go through many of the painful experiences that we have. But I guess the bigger question is, what next? What do you do with it? And Amy seems to have chosen to advance herself in life in spite of the things that caused her pain. And that is not to say that that pain doesn't impact her, but it doesn't seem to rule her life. And if I ever get an opportunity to sit down with Amy again, I think I'm going to ask her how that happened. What that particular process entailed. She's kind of teasing, you know, and it sounds like she gets teased by friends and family from, you know, sometimes that she called herself pretty chatty, I think is what she said. Well, Amy, nobody's more chatty than I am. Chatty or not, I would also use the word poignant. Anywho, really enjoyed my conversation with her. Part two should be released shortly. You know, in kind of listening to our conversation as I was doing some editing. I, you know, not to get too overly philosophical or anything. But I thought about St. John of the Cross. And again, philosophical, theological, whatever, that my purpose is not necessarily to preach, but to kind of share an idea. And St. John of the Cross wrote the Dark Night of the Soul. And he said, you know, in suffering, the soul practices and acquires virtue and becomes pure, wiser, and more cautious. And that was just kind of what I thought. It was just a very congruous message with Amy's story. She is truly somebody that I have a deep amount of respect for, having had a nice conversation with her and listened to her story and listened to what she thought about things and where she's been, what has happened, and what she has done. Just a really fantastic individual. So thank you for listening to part one of my conversation with Amy. Part two should be out shortly. And if you would like to be a part of this podcast, please send an inquiry to the inbox, weighinginwithpatrick@gmail.com. You can also catch me at a meeting Saturday mornings. The 9 a.m. meeting starts at 9 a.m. as usual. I'm usually there between 8:15 and 8:30 to weigh in and get a seat, etc. Or if you would just like to talk about what might go into this and where do we go? You know, Amy actually came to the home office of the Weighing In podcast to record. Our next featured Rock Hill WW member is going to be Martha Jean. And shortly I will be traveling to her home to record our conversation. I really look forward to that. So be on the lookout for that episode. And I hope that your day and your week goes well, and that whatever trials or travails you are currently experiencing or have experienced don't cause you to give up hope. Just hang in there. One more step. If all you can do is just get out of bed, do that, right? And if you're able to, come to a meeting. And 9 a.m. Saturdays, and there's other meetings during the week. Get some support. Don't rob people of the opportunity to support you when you need it. If you are faced with overwhelming issues, don't be afraid to reach out to professionals to give you a hand if you think that that is going, it could possibly be helpful, counselors and therapists. And I'm always available to speak with you about what kind of counselor or therapist might be most helpful for you. So have a great week. Have a great day. Be good to yourself. And no matter what, don't give up, because you can do it. Take care.
bear.